What does it look like to become a church historian? In this episode, we speak with Adam Bond about his journey from the church to the university, back to the church, and now back to the university with us here at Baylor. It's an interesting and compelling story. Stick around. You are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. My guest today is Adam Bond. He is Associate Professor of Religion and African American Studies here at Baylor University, a post he took up in August of 2023. We are fortunate to have him in the department. Not only does he bring knowledge and expertise, but his gentle, thoughtful presence is a gift to colleagues and students alike. Dr. Bond pastored a couple of churches before arriving at Baylor, including the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church of Richmond, Virginia. He is the author of several books and is currently working on another, tentatively titled Read the Text First: Black Baptist Leaders, Race Literature, and the Salvation of America, 1930 to 1970. Which is under contract with Mercer University Press. I'm excited for you to hear about his story and his scholarship. So, here is our conversation. Dr. Adam Bond, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to be in this conversation with you.
As a new faculty, we'd love to hear a little bit about your story. How did you become a church historian?
Well, that's a story that I have not been asked often, but when I have been asked that question, I have really tried to imagine that moment of conversion, so to speak, in which I have... in which I felt a sense of call, a sense of something compelling within me that drew me to the material, that drew me to a certain set of questions. And really, it boiled down to, I was always curious about what was going on in church and how we arrived at these practices and rituals and traditions that we continue to practice Sunday after Sunday. Those questions continue to be with me from some of my earliest days, like when I was baptized, to eventually in sitting in seminary, reading these different books that began to offer those light bulb moments in which I said, that came from that. Mm-hmm. And, we do these things because of... These moments in history. From there, I really wanted to read more, study more. And before I knew it, I had professors in my ear saying, you should consider a PhD. Hmm. And if these are the kinds of things you want to read and write about, you should consider studying in a PhD program. And that made sense to me because I recognized how much I appreciated and enjoyed being in the classroom.
Yeah.
I also recognized that the classroom was a space in which we could have conversations that we were not having in church spaces.
Sure.
And those classrooms allowed me an opportunity to ask questions that weren't necessarily, people in churches weren't necessarily answering or weren't as direct about as what I felt like I received in the classrooms. It became history because I thought the history books that I read, I thought they made sense in terms of talking about those rituals, those traditions, those practices. And before I knew it, I was hooked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And interesting, that you found space in classrooms that were dealing with questions you felt like you had a desire to hear more about. But that didn't lead you away from the church. You served as a pastor for some time. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I served as a pastor for a total of about 7 years. 3 and a half years in two different places.
Okay.
Around my, I think it was about my seventh year of teaching at the seminary from which I graduated, mm-hmm. the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology okay. at Virginia Union University, I sensed that I could do more or that I should be doing more in terms of making real some of the big ideas I had for the church.
Yeah.
There happened to be a congregation, a small rural congregation, that invited me to come and present the message on Father's Day.
Mm.
And I went out there with no sense that I was going to, you know, consider being the church's pastor. I was just, not just, but I was a pulpit supply minister
sure,
on
yeah.
that occasion. I got there. The people really appreciated what I offered and asked me to come back for the homecoming celebration on the first Sunday in September. Between that date, between that July date and September, I was asked to also submit my resume for a pastoral position at a church in the city. And I received from the chair of the search committee a promise that the process would probably be about 3 months. So I said, that process feels better than what a lot of Baptist pulpit search committees,
sure.
How long they normally deliberate.
Yeah.
So I'll submit my application for that. And it was so funny because it was not funny, but it was interesting that the pulpit search committee at the church that promised a quick deliberation really moved slowly
yeah.
from what they had promised. But the other church, by the time I kind of felt like, you know what, I don't know if this is working out waiting on this other church. The church that invited me back for the homecoming celebration, the Sunday where all of these members were mm-hmm. coming back from all of these different places, I went there, and that second time I was there, I started to connect with the people.
Yeah.
And I felt like I could do something to
yeah.
to help the people move forward in their faith. I submitted my application. They called me back in about 2 weeks and
yeah.
said, we'd like to interview you. And before I knew it, I was participating in that pastoral search process. And I asked the other one to remove my application from
yeah.
consideration. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience in which the people were just amazing. The Providence Baptist Church of Ashland, Virginia. For 3.5 years, I did my best to serve as faithfully as I possibly could. And I love those people dearly, and they love me dearly. We even continue to check in from time to time. The other church, so I was bivocational at that time. The other church was a historic downtown congregation that I, again, felt a sense of call to because of what I believed I could offer and contribute to the growth and development of that congregation.
Mm.
It just so happened that the first Sunday of my time as the pastor was the first Sunday in March of 2020.
Oh, and welcome to the church.
Yes, and 2 weeks later, I had the tough task of telling the people that
right.
we were going to suspend all activities in the building.
Right.
And the other interesting thing about that was that it was an older congregation that didn't rely as much upon technology. So, you know, the pandemic created a moment in which all of these churches turned to technology
uh-huh.
as a way to stay connected. And we were building infrastructure and trying to figure out new ways to connect with an older congregation
yeah.
that didn't use technology, with a church that didn't have technology,
right.
and in a situation that no one understood what we were getting ourselves into as
mm-hmm.
we walked through the whole experience of the global pandemic. But it turned out to be an amazing experience of about 3.5 years in which we trusted that God was up to something in our journeys, and we took steps on ground on which we did not know if it would be firm or not. But again, we trusted that God would bring us through. And before we knew it, it worked out really well. Older people who had never even heard of Zoom were using Zoom for Bible study. Older people who didn't necessarily use YouTube weekly, you know, were watching it every week for the Sunday service. And just an amazing experience in terms of being a pastoral leader in those two settings at the times in which I was called to be, to walk with the people.
Yeah. You mentioned, first of all, that's lovely. And COVID, I remember also being a pastor as that set in. What a challenge. Yeah. So God bless you for taking that on and for being there for the people and walking with them through that in a way that seems like was a blessing to them. You had mentioned in your story about your journey to becoming a historian that there were certain conversations that weren't taking place in the church that you were able to explore in seminary classes and church history classes. I wonder if during those 6-7 years of pastoring, you were able to bring some of those conversations into those churches. And if so, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So as a church historian, one of the I think the major contributions of church history that people are of which people are not familiar or aware is that the story of the church didn't start and or end with them. And so as I chose to start, especially the last, my last pastoral ministry, I recognized that it was important to honor the history of that congregation.
Right.
But to tell the story within the context of the story of the Christian church, universal. So what I did was I said, I think people could really benefit from knowing that every Christian age, you know, every Christian era in terms of the church universal has its ups and its downs, its challenges, its, you know, its advances, its moments in which it raised serious questions about what it meant to be church.
Yeah.
And I started my time as pastor saying that we can benefit from hearing the story of these Christians who didn't have a roadmap, but were trying to make sense of everything in light of their beliefs.
Yeah.
And as a part of that, they were willing to ask hard questions in many instances, and sometimes they dismissed the hard questions and chose easy answers. But we have an opportunity to lay out a path in which we are informed by history, and we can choose to ask the difficult questions, and or we can choose to dismiss them and just keep doing business as usual.
Right.
So I, you know, I started with a Bible study in which we walked through the history of the church. And we went from, primarily, we went from the early church to Luther, or to the Reformation at least, as a way to say, okay, you see how even the church as it understood itself took these different directions as in terms of the way that, in which it formed. But it happened because people were willing to challenge in some ways what was considered orthodox, challenge what was considered to be status quo. Now, I'm going somewhere with this then in terms of I had in mind that it was important to invite us to not just receive tradition, but to assess tradition.
Right.
And I don't think I would have had that mind if I hadn't, if I had not understood what I believe was the power of history as a resource for how we as people can grow.
I love that.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more then, having transitioned from pastorate to back into teaching full-time here at Baylor, How would you say that some of those conversations, or do those conversations, continue to influence your work here?
You know, I believe those moments in terms of my pastoral ministry influence who I am as a person for sure.
Yeah.
So I have a care for every student who walks into my mm-hmm. classroom. I have a sense that I am supposed to be a person who can be a resource person in terms of not just the material mm-hmm. that we read and study in class, but of life in general.
Yeah.
And that it is important for me to hold with care the anxieties, the questions, the concerns, even the celebrations that students bring to each moment that we interact with each other during the semester. Mm. And so with that, I think that is one of the lasting effects of pastoral ministry mm-hmm. on even where I am. So the classroom is not a church for me necessarily,
right?
But it is a space in which the pastoral call that has been, you know, in my life mm-hmm. is at work, is operative.
Right.
The other aspect, though, of that in terms of some of the questions around what it means to be church, mm-hmm. you know, that being at Baylor, where faith is such an integral part of how this institution understands what it means to be authentically Baylor, we can wrestle with questions of faith. We can think deeply about what the church is in light of what it has been, mm-hmm. and that for students who embrace a walk of faith, especially within Christian traditions, but within all traditions, that the classroom can be a space in which everyone has an opportunity to assess and evaluate
right.
what we have inherited.
Yeah.
So I think it's fun on some level to be in a space where we can be brave enough to raise questions about what it means to be people of faith, what it means to live in a world in which this thing called church exists, mm-hmm. and then what is our responsibility as mm-hmm. citizens of, you know, the country, the world, you know, and then if as people of the Christian faith, of the Commonwealth of God, what is our responsibility then to use this space wisely and to raise some questions that may not only help us in our journey as people, as individuals, but as a global community.
Yeah, good.
You are listening to Currents in Religion, and I'm speaking with Adam Bond, Associate Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Baylor University. We'll get back to our conversation in a moment, but first, I'd like to share a little chat I had with the folks at Baylor Press about a book I think you might find interesting. I've got Dave Nelson here with me. He's the director of Baylor University Press, and he is going to tell us about a new Baylor University Press book.
Thanks, Zen. Christians in the United States and around the world find themselves politically polarized today, unable to speak to one another across deep divisions ripped open by urgent social issues. It is tempting to abandon hope for patient civil discourse in this charged political atmosphere. Polarization has become the norm, and the issues that divide are always present in the news, on social media, in schools and in homes, in places of worship, in the marketplace, everywhere. Christian theology has typically been a source of discord rather than a remedy during times dominated by polarized politics. However, in Ordinary Faith in Polarized Times, published by Baylor University Press last fall, Amy Carr and Christine Helmer argue that theology might indeed help Christians dismantle political divisions. The foundation of ordinary faith, they show, is the Christian theological understanding of justification, the teaching that righteousness comes from beyond, namely, through the Word of God who justifies and is received by faith that yields good fruit in works of love. The doctrine of justification thus provides Christians with a rich theological account of human being and relationships that, in turn, becomes the basis of the pursuit of justice in the world, enabling Christians to establish peace with those who might otherwise be regarded as enemies. For Carr and Helmer, then, justification by faith in Christ is not only the ground, source, and goal of the Christian life, but serves as the cornerstone of Christian belonging and community and the wellspring of a political ethic prioritizing justice-seeking and civil discourse. Drawing an analogy between the parables of Jesus and the power of stories to inform life and practice, Carr and Helmer articulate ways that justification by faith grounds Christian practices of effective listening and storytelling, even on the most contentious ethical questions today, with the hope that mutual conversation, carried out in and through the beloved community, can get Christians who disagree oriented toward each other again for the good of the world. Stories then become the vehicle for defeating discord.
Love that. Dave, thanks for introducing us to this book. And listeners, if you are interested, you can learn more either by visiting the book's page in the link in the episode description below, or you can check out our episode with them, which aired in the fall 2023 season. Now back to our main interview. Tell us a little bit more about your research, your scholarship out, that informs the classroom, but that you're doing outside of the classroom too.
Yes. So it's funny because I've been so immersed in the classroom that I wonder if I still know how to research. well, in the classroom and in the church. But really, my research is about telling those stories that sometimes get lost. In light of the fact that either they don't fit grand narratives that we create about mm-hmm. what it means to be church, what it means to be Baptist, what it means to live in the United States, to be Christian and an American, or you name it, right? And I zero in specifically on the ideas and contributions of African Americans, and so I think deeply about the ideas mm-hmm. that these wonderful people within history, the history of this nation, the wonderful ideas that they produced.
Yeah.
And I do my best to interrogate, raise questions, and examine what they believed they were contributing to mm-hmm. larger conversations, but also what they contribute to questions that we may even raise today.
Yeah.
And for me, that looks like a project like what I turned into my book on Samuel DeWitt Proctor, mm-hmm. Thinking about, and it's an intellectual history in which I think about the legacy of this giant who was the president of mm-hmm. two historically black colleges, two historically black universities. He was the pastor of the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, New York, mm-hmm. following Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Even before that, he spent years in public service as a part of the Kennedy administration okay. and as a part of the Johnson administration, and especially with the Johnson administration helping to produce what, you know, Lyndon Johnson hoped to be the Great Society. And mm-hmm. so I believe that there is something there in terms of telling these stories. And I believe they help us understand that the stories are bigger sometimes, a lot of times, than the larger narratives that we create that may be easier mm-hmm. or may feel more accessible.
Yeah.
So if we think about, for example, the civil rights movement, for so many textbooks in classrooms across America in terms of elementary schools, high schools, you know, mm-hmm. Junior highs, you name it. And then even in college, in some colleges, you get the story that it's Martin Luther King Jr. and that's it.
Yeah.
When the story is so much richer mm-hmm. and so much more complex. Mm-hmm. So Samuel DeWitt Proctor was someone King looked up to in terms of how Proctor operated in ministry.
Yeah.
He was someone that King looked up to in terms of of how Proctor combined the quote unquote scholarly and the spiritual, right? The intellect and the spirit. So that when King looked at Proctor, he saw a model for ministry. Mm-hmm. Now, King saw many models, but Proctor was one of them. And Proctor was kind of close enough in age as a peer. But one of the things we don't realize is like this whole environment in which King grew up in, and many King scholars, you know, do a great job of showing. But even those King scholars focus on persons such as Benjamin Mays, Howard Thurman, and a few others. But that doesn't tell the story about those formative people in the lives of Benjamin Mays and Howard Thurman.
Right.
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 That there's this whole Black Baptist world that helped produce all of them, right? That helped, that were, that was formative in the ways in which all of those persons emerged as leaders within our nation, with women and men helping to influence their ideas. Nannie Helen Burroughs, a Virginia Broughton who set things in motion where publications were such a rich part of a Black Baptist life. A Black, you know, a Black Baptist newspaper, you know, the National Baptist Magazine as the forerunner to the National Baptist Voice. And people such as King were picking up these newspapers and reading the ideas of all of these preachers and these missionaries and these leaders. So then for me, I didn't hear that story when I heard the civil rights story, but it helps explain how King becomes a Martin Luther King Jr. becomes a Martin Luther King Jr., how Samuel DeWitt Proctor becomes a Samuel DeWitt Proctor. And those are the stories that I want to tell. It fits well, I think, in this moment, because so much of how we understand scholarship is becoming interdisciplinary in many ways. And so it's okay now to look at preachers and their sermons
and as see, a source for a movement or history.
As another kind of canon for where we can find riches in our scholarly endeavors. So I'm excited about it. And the other thing is, in some ways, scholarship shifted at some point beyond denominational histories and things of that nature. But I think there's an opportunity to still to tell some of these stories and to tell them in ways that are compelling enough and accessible enough for us to have some rich conversations that help us understand religion in America, Christianity in America, you know, African-American religion, you name it.
Yeah, it's important work. So your bio says that you have a forthcoming book called Read the Text First, Black Baptist Leaders, Race Literature, and the Salvation of America, 1930 to 1970. Give us an update. What's that looking like?
Yes. So one update is that the name of the book is probably going to change. It's changed at least twice since I started it. But it will probably change one more time in light of what I am seeing in the archival materials, in the sources that I'm reading. The book itself is meant to be an examination of several Black Baptist leaders, who some much more visible, some much more celebrated in terms of some of the historical works on Baptist history that we read on Christianity in America, some lesser known, some whose ideas and work may be seeing the light in terms of scholarship, or might be even the first time, from what I'm gathering in terms of what the bibliographies are telling me.
Yeah.
The goal of the book is to, in some ways, argue that Black Baptist leaders during that critical period in American history were seeking to write into existence the leaders that they felt Black people needed in America. And in writing them into existence, so to speak, these leaders hope to both embody what they believe the world needed, but they also desire to leave in some ways a canon that could guide the way for those who felt a sense of call to become those leaders. So that's the read the text part,
okay,
right?
Got
read
it.
The text first. It actually comes from a quote from Nanny Helen Burroughs in which
okay.
she's in a debate with, she's in this invented debate, so to speak, with several leaders. She wrote this op-ed, this syndicated op-ed.
Okay.
And on one occasion during the Depression, she basically said to preachers, you know, you all could do more to help lead our people mm-hmm. to where they need to be in this moment. And here's how. And she got a lot of pushback from the readers because some of them felt that that was undue criticism. And some of them applauded what she said and said, now let's even add to it more of what we should be doing. So this whole debate turns into this moment in which Nanny Helen Burroughs comes back and says, okay, many of you all are getting upset about nothing. You should read the text first.
There you
and
go.
Then you would
That's
see,
right.
you know, and she basically says to them, you know, hey, if you're preachers, don't you read the Bible first before you go into the pulpit and preach?
Uh-huh.
You should have read my text first before you came back at me with all of this foolishness, basically.
Uh-huh.
What I realized is that this was a moment in which several people across different genres of literature were producing text mm-hmm. in which they were articulating what they believe leaders should look like
right.
in those moments. And so I started in 1930, mm-hmm. you know, basically at the start of the Depression, and I end with what is technically the end of the Civil Rights
okay.
movement as mm-hmm. we knew it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at all of these different leaders you know, providing these templates for mm-hmm. how leaders should lead in these moments. I look at everything from op-eds to autobiographies to even a dissertation as a part of this examination of how these Black Baptist leaders sought to articulate what it meant to lead Black people in those critical moments of history.
That is a fascinating period to think with. I'm just struck too, just kind of off the top of my head, thinking about the economic challenges of the Depression, the conflicts of World War II and civil rights, all of those things having such, you know, not in the same ways, of course, but analogous sorts of things over the past decade of American life. As you've been reading these sources and thinking about the vision that they're offering of leaders, is there something that you have said, we need to put our finger on this now?
So yes and no.
Okay.
The yes part of it is I celebrate that they were willing to debate so publicly
mm-hmm.
These ideas
mm-hmm.
Because I believe that the public debate invited an opportunity for people,
mm-hmm.
for the masses to think about these matters, these issues.
Right.
And in doing that, and even in doing it in writing, it created a moment or moments in which people could really
mm-hmm.
read the text first
and
raise these questions about, what should we be doing? And that's the other aspect of the project is how, you know, it created these opportunities for debate, for dialogue, for resistance.
Yeah.
Not just against the larger white racist structures that they were mm-hmm. fighting back against, but against each other.
Right.
To say that there's no one easy answer.
Yeah.
That, I think, is very helpful in terms of thinking about the times in which we live. Because there were similar debates, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they were as robust around the Black Lives Matter movement,
right.
the role of the church in social protests,
mm-hmm.
Even today. So mm-hmm. when we think about all of the murders of African Americans during mm-hmm. that period,
mm-hmm.
You know, people were saying, well, those young people ought not protest like that, but there was there wasn't necessarily an alternative, or there weren't, for me, I didn't necessarily see the robust dialogue take place that could have taken place.
Right.
Well, it's understandable though, because some of it's happening on social media and some people aren't going to social media, right?
Yeah.
Some of it's happening in the church and some people aren't coming into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we might benefit from thinking about what they did and how creatively we can model, not necessarily doing it the way they did it, but model the idea that dialogue is necessary,
right,
to advance,
right,
to move forward in the world. Mm. I think that's important.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, I'll say, and this is just my personal bias, that much of the dialogue, even as it was very public in newspapers, in books, things of that nature, it was taking place in denominational settings.
Mm.
And when you look at denominational records and minutes, you see them trying to think through how to lift up the race,
right?
How to help African-American people navigate,
mm-hmm,
the racist dynamics of Jim Crow, the you know, last hired, first fired practices and during the Depression.
Right.
And they're hashing it out in denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us talk about this as a post-denominational moment.
Right.
And I think there's still some good that can come when we acknowledge that maybe we're better together,
mm-hmm,
than we are apart.
Yeah.
Working in silos, you know, mm-hmm, developing our own conferences, conventions, and things of that nature, that when we have structures that maybe need to be reformed rather than dismissed,
sure,
or thrown out.
Yeah.
Those are some of the questions that I would raise and pose to an audience that might read this book in,
yeah,
terms of thinking about what are the contemporary, mm-hmm, ways in which we can receive this material as a lesson for how we do our best selves, how,
yeah,
we be our most faithful and authentic selves in light of the mm-hmm challenges that we face in the world.
Yeah. I'm curious, as you undertake this work, you've made a move here to Baylor. I'm curious, what appealed to you specifically about teaching and researching here? Were there specific initiatives or collaboratives or collections that you felt would sustain your own interests and work here at Baylor in a unique kind of way?
I appreciated the opportunity to walk with conversation partners who are thinking about questions along or about, mm-hmm, in terms of Baptist history,
mm-hmm,
the Baptist traditions.
Mm-hmm.
That was appealing to me. The opportunity to be at Baylor in this moment in which there is this energy that is so supportive of research, mm-hmm, like the research that I'm doing, that was very appealing. The colleagues that I have, I've, you know, met along the way in different spaces, and the opportunity to work with them in terms of the collegial energy and the sense of community that resides in the Department of Religion for sure, but across, mm, Baylor, it was, you know, compelling enough to make me say, oh, sure, I'll move to Waco, Texas. So I apologize. That was a low blow.
Yeah.
But that was all a part of what made me say this was a good moment for our family to consider moving,
mm-hmm,
to Waco.
Mm-hmm.
And Baylor, being so unapologetically, you know, in many instances Baptist and or Christian university,
mm-hmm,
in ways that we're still, I think, defining.
Yep, for sure.
But in ways that reflect a lot of good,
mm-hmm,
that this institution is doing, has done, and will do. Those were things that made me say yes. It felt good to come to a space, a university, that celebrates the books that I write for the church as much as it celebrates the books that I write that are meant to be conversation resources in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
It felt good to come to a place that says, oh, you're an ordained Baptist minister. We appreciate the perspective you can provide,
mm-hmm,
as an ordained Baptist minister. And as a scholar in these spaces and what we believe, how we believe our students can be that much better by being in conversation with you. All of that made me say, this is a great time to be at Baylor.
Well, Dr. Bond, we are lucky to have you. I'm happy you're here. Thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion and telling us a little bit about your story and your scholarship.
Thank you.
Hey again. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Adam Bond. If you did, make sure you share it with others who might like it too. If you haven't already, subscribe so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you would, leave a review. It'll help us know how we're doing and help others to find this podcast. In next week's episode, I speak with Gary Dorian, a distinguished theological ethicist and historian, about his new book, Anglican Identities. I hope you'll listen in. Until then, take care.